Welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 11. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I am looking at one of my favourite science fiction films of about 10 years ago, The Core from 2003, and I'll tell you why I like it even though the science is rubbish. There's some great news from the planet Mars that I'll be sharing with you. And just to top things off, I'm going to do something I did once before, which is I'm going to do a year-by-year recommendation of one movie per year of science fiction from 1930 until the present day. So sit back, relax, and we will get there.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a four-weekly podcast of speculative fiction movie appreciation. Each 4 weeks, Terry and his guests will pick two movies and strip them to the bone. They can be new, old, or in between science fiction, fantasy, or horror. What they have in common is that they aren't the big blockbusters that everyone knows about. Martian Drive-In looks for the interesting films that might not be on your radar, but that might just be worth your attention and appreciation. Go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com. Feedback is always welcome via email at cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. Or you can leave a voicemail at area code 206-2033-299. Enjoy!
And I've got to add to Sal's intro that you can also go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook, and you can also leave a voicemail at marsdrivein.blogspot.com as well. There's a little thingy on the side of the webpage which will allow you to record your own feedback. How is everybody? We're doing fine here. It's summertime and the living is easy. The veggie patch is going great. We seem to have a whole bunch of apple cucumbers, which are about the size of ostrich eggs, and they're going mad, and they may well take over the yard. They're the new Triffid, really, and a little bit concerned, but not too much. So eventually the weather will turn bad, and the plants will die out, and we'll have to plant a winter veg. So we've got that going. Nothing much else really going on. Apparently in a couple of days, an asteroid the size of a sporting field is going to pass within about 15,000 miles or something like that of the planet Earth. And nobody's particularly worried about it, but it does make us aware of the fact that we do live in a bit of a pinball machine called the solar system, and that occasionally other objects may intersect with our own and cause potential problems. So I'm kind of looking forward to that one. I think that anything that raises the awareness of what's out there and what we need to do to go out there and enjoy ourselves and discover the solar system at the very least is a good thing. I do hope that nothing hits us very hard and very fast, particularly if it is very large, because that could affect the real estate value of my home, and I would not want that to happen at all. As I said, we're doing pretty well here. No big dramas, no big surprises, no big hassles. I've kind of gone a bit easy. We're saving a little bit of money because we want to go on a holiday, so I've been going a little bit easy on my rampant Blu-ray purchasing. So that's kind of on hold. And I will let you know, too, that I've actually got the next Martian Drive-In podcast set up already with our friend Nick Sauer again. We're going to do a couple of superhero movies just for shits and giggles. Next time around, you're going to get 1999's Mystery Men, and you're also going to get a very much smaller science fiction movie called The Specials, which was directed by James Gunn, who people may know from a few other things like Super, for one thing. And also, he's now directing one of the next Marvel franchise movies, Guardians of the Galaxy. So I thought that there'd be a timely time to take a look at one of his early efforts as specials. And I know that there are a number of people out there who have a great fondness for that movie. So that's just for next time around, and should be a bit of fun. And Nick and I will get together and put on our capes and our masks and slide down some poles and give you the skinny on those two films. So, as I said, this time around, we are doing The Core, which I love, even though the science is a bit dubious. And rather than doing a second film, and I was trying to scratch my head and see what I wanted to do, and all of the movies that I wanted to do, and I do have a fairly extensive list of these, I want to do them with somebody else. So rather than doing a second one, about going for five years ago, with Paleo Cinema Podcast, I did a thing where I just ranted for the whole podcast, recommending science fiction movies, one a year from 1930. And I'm going to do that again. I'm going to pick different movies, but because it's an old podcast and because I want to challenge myself again, and I'm also going to try to add some audio in between, illustrating the films that I talk about, I thought I'd give that another go. It's a bit of a mental exercise for me. I'm going to break it up a little bit so that you're not getting ranted at continuously in a big long stream, 70 or 80 movies long. But I just thought I'd do a little bit of a stretch there. The other thing that's been happening is I'm working on my secret project. Now, it's probably going to be a movie book of some kind, or a very extensive movie blog. I haven't decided which yet. It depends on whether I can get it published or not, but I'm about 10,000 words into it and making it a kind of personal view of my history as a cinephile, as well as throwing in lots and lots of recommendations of movies. And the core's going to be in there because I have already written up a fairly extensive bit about the core, so I'm going to include that as well, which is challenging. But not too bad. I did do another radio gig as well recently. Richard Margetson from ABC Darwin called me up and said, "Do you want to do Tarantino Django Unchained? Has come out in Darwin and it's the biggest box office movie in Australia this week. Do you want to have a bit of a chat with a guy called Adam and me about the history of Quentin Tarantino?" So we did about 20 minutes of that, kind of, you know, the three of us taking turns of talking. It was a lot of fun. It's very much a different gig than the two-hander that Ivor and I used to do for a couple of years. But we got in a little bit about Tarantino and had a bit of a chat about that, playing to and fro and just kind of talking about what we liked of his stuff and his style and all of that sort of thing. It was kind of, I kind of miss the old gig, to be really honest with you. I love the new one in the sense that I enjoy being asked to do it, and it's a bit of a stretch for me to get into the different headspaces of modern films rather than the older ones. But I do enjoy the stretch, even though, being the greedy kind of person I am, I wish it was in the old format. I really enjoyed that leisurely, solid half an hour of Ivor and I just talking about a film. And there's nothing to say I'm not going to eventually at one stage get Ivor on as a guest on a podcast. The only problem is I've got to teach him how to use Skype. He's not the greatest technophile that I know. Lovely guy, and he can work the console on a radio station, but I may have to do a visit to Darwin and pop up there and show him and his wife Casey how to use Skype pretty well, and we can do a little bit of a groovy chat there on a film or two. So I'm going to kind of, I haven't told him yet, but I'm going to pop that on as a question onto him when we next see each other and see what we can do. Now it's time for a little bit of a break. I'm going to do a podcast promo in here because I haven't been keeping up on my podcast promos for people. I do apologize for that. And when I get back, I'm going to be talking about the 2003 film The Core, starring Aaron Eckhart, Hilary Swank, Bruce Greenwood, Checky Cario, Dore Lindo, and Stanley Tucci.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, wasn't that an 80s cop show on ABC with David Raich?
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Downplays can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplays.com.
Wait, that was Sledgehammer.
1951 Downplays, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Okay, on to The Core. The Core, is, as I said, is a 2003 movie directed by John Amiel. And I'm going to play the trailer for it now, but be aware, there are spoilers in the trailer. Nothing drastic, but I think the trailer that they put together for this film really does it a disservice and gives away one particular plot point. Not necessarily a greatly important one, but just... It shouldn't have been done this way, but having said that, I'll play it for you now.
It was a secret government program known as Project Destiny.
We're building a weapon that could generate targeted seismic events.
Designed to use earthquakes to attack our enemies.
I'm getting a seismic reading.
It was a perfect, untraceable weapon.
Destiny is a go.
Until something went wrong.
That's an electrical superstorm.
Popping up all over the world.
I'll put this as simply as I can. Everybody on Earth is dead in a year.
The core of the Earth has stopped spinning. The spinning core protects us from cosmic radiation.
Without it, radiation will create superstorms. Microwaves will literally cook our planet.
How could this have happened?
It was Project Destiny. We killed the planet.
So, how do we fix it?
We can't.
The core is the size of Mars. You're talking about jump-starting a planet.
What if we could?
We're here about your legendary ship.
What would it take to get it in 3 months?
$50 billion.
Can you take a check?
I need you to control the flow of information.
You want me to hack the planet? I'm gonna need Star Trek tapes and Hot Pockets.
You are good.
Is there anything you can't do?
Not that I'm aware of.
You're trying to save the world. It's impossible. I came here to save my wife and children. I just hope I'm brave enough to save three.
I can't wait to get into an untested ship, go to the center of the Earth, and restart its core with 1,000 megatons of nuclear weapons. Then we outrun the biggest shockwave in history.
Hot damn.
San Francisco is in ruins.
The whole West Coast is out.
And it's decaying faster than we thought.
2, 1.
We're going in.
Get ready to pull fugitives.
Whoever goes into the core is not coming back.
We're losing oxygen!
Breach!
We got a job to do. Let's do it.
Yeah, that plot point for about Project Destiny comes in about two-thirds of the way into the film, yet they gave it away in the trailer. I think the best we can expect is to tell them that they've done it wrong and ask them not to do it again, because not really cool to do that. There is an art to trailers. In fact, some film directors have started out making trailers for films. One that I know of, Brian Trenchard-Smith, started out cutting together Hammer trailers, amongst other things. So they got that wrong in the trailer, but we'll forgive them that. Now, really, why am I doing this particular movie for this particular podcast? For me, The Core is probably one of the three or four best science fiction adventure movies of the 21st century. But right off the bat, I've got to admit, they got some of the science wrong. But really, I don't care. This is a story about how human ingenuity and scientific breakthroughs and sheer guts can solve problems that we create. At the heart of it, it's really strongly a science fictional film, so I can kind of forgive the inaccuracies and go along for the ride. So let's have a look. One of the things the director John Amiel has said is he was trying to make a character-driven science fiction adventure film, which is a big ask. I mean, I think the Avengers did that to a certain extent, but Amiel tried it about 10 years ago. So we've got the cast. We've got Aaron Eckhart. He's playing Josh Keyes, the scientist who finds out that the inner core of the Earth has stopped revolving and that everything's going to hell in a handbasket. You've got Hilary Swank in there. I'm not really that fond of Hilary Swank as an actor. I think that there's something about her that I didn't really take to very well. But in this one, I do like her, which goes to show either my tastes are ineffably geeky, or there's something she brought to this film she didn't really bring to some other films. Let's see. So she's playing Rebecca Childs, who's an astronaut. You've got Delroy Lindo, a great British actor, and most people don't know that he was born in London, playing Ed Brazelton, who invents the ship that takes the crew into the centre of the Earth. You got Stanley Tucci as Konrad Zimsky. Stanley Tucci, great character actor. Big Night, one of my favourite films ever about food, and he was very much a big part of that. You've got DJ Qualls playing Rat, who is a hacker who basically hacks the planet to keep the news about the inner core fucking up away from everybody. You got Richard Jenkins playing General Purcell, who's the army guy. You got Checky Cario playing Serge Levesque, who's one of the scientists, and Bruce Greenwood playing the commander of the mission, Robert Iverson. So the ensemble is in this film is pretty damn good. I think they've got some great character actors in there, and really that's one of the saving graces of this film. But what I'm going to do now is I'm going to kind of address the scientific inaccuracies. And to do that, I've got to thank Bad Astronomy blog, because they put together a piece about the core, and it covers a lot of the stuff that is scientifically inaccurate about the film. And yet they did say they liked it, so they're forgiving. The thing is that it's not major scientific inaccuracies. It's kind of a tweak here and there. For instance, you're not going to get the core, inner core of the Earth to stop revolving. There are convection flows in it, even though it is kind of revolving, there are convection flows in it and all sorts of other bits and pieces. What they would have been better doing is saying that the convection flows and the currents in the inner core have gone chaotic, rather than saying that it's stopped. Yeah, a little bit of a problem there, but it's not something they couldn't have tweaked in the script. So you've got that for a start. Let's have a look here. Now, before I do that, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to kind of give you this scenario. Some weird things start happening. In Boston, 26 people with pacemakers drop dead all of a sudden. In Trafalgar Square, all the pigeons go nuts and can't navigate anymore and start bashing into trees and London cabs and rolling over double-decker buses and all sorts of horrible things happening there. And you've got weird electrical storms happening, really intense ones with hundreds and hundreds of lightning strikes per square mile happening. So there's basically something seriously going wrong. And they bring in Josh Keyes because he's an expert at geomagnetism. He picks out that everybody who died had a pacemaker within about a minute of seeing the corpses. So, you know, this guy's a great scientist and he's intuitive. And him and his mate Serge are brought in to investigate that. He then looks into things a little bit further and finds out that things are worse than they seem. So he shirt-collars a celebrity scientist, think kind of Neil deGrasse Tyson crossed with Carl Sagan, crossed with an egotistical bastard, and you've pretty much got Stanley Tucci's Konrad Zimsky down pat. So he shirt-collars Konrad Zimsky, shows him the work. Zimsky looks at it and has, like all of the characters in the movie pretty much do, has a what-the-fuck moment as he realises that life on Earth isn't going to be around much longer. Now, they do have a thing where the natural magnetic field around the Earth fucks up and microwaves come down and start frying things. That's one of the scientific inaccuracies. Microwaves don't do that. There aren't any microwaves coming out of the sun. There are high-energy particles and there are other things coming out via solar flares and stuff like that, but it's not going to happen like it did in the movie, but it looks good. So we'll forgive them a couple of little bits and pieces of inaccuracy. And one of the other great things that happens is Bob Iverson and Beck are landing the space shuttle at Vandenberg Air Base, which was one of the alternative landing spots for the space shuttle. If Florida was stormed in, they then go to Vandenberg as their second landing site. Only problem is that the navigation satellites have gone FUBAR, and there's suddenly break through a cloud layer, and they're about to land in the middle of Los Angeles. Now, this is a really cool sequence in this film. It really does carry the film really well. They do find a landing site in the Los Angeles River and land there, and it's a great adventurous bit of fluff and conceit. It's a good way to use special effects without going over the top. They do clip a couple of things, mostly bridges and a few other bits and pieces there. So, yeah, not they don't go totally Michael Bay on the city of Los Angeles, but they do land a space shuttle in the LA River, which, if nothing else, is incredibly cool. And you've got to remember that the LA River is a kind of iconic science fiction setting as well. If you remember way back in 1953, giant ant movie then, the ants were in the sewers underneath Los Angeles, and they kind of went in with jeeps and flamethrowers and James Whitmore through the sewers leading from the LA River. So it's kind of very much an iconic thing. I think they did a bit of The Terminator in it. They've done a number of other movies. Buckaroo Banzai and his crew marched around a piece of culvert that looked a bit like the LA River at the end of the film as well. So the LA River is a kind of iconic science fiction setting, a little bit like the way Griffith Park Observatory is, thanks to parts of Flesh Gordon being filmed there. So you've got a space shuttle out of control landing there. You've got everybody slowly realizing that the planet is totally up the creek. And they get this eccentric, reclusive scientist, Braz Brazelton, played really well by Delroy Lindo, who has a couple of bits and pieces up his sleeve which are really useful, one of which is a material called unobtainium, which he calls unobtainium, which essentially is something that's going to be used to encase the ship going down into the center of the Earth.
Voila. That's impossible.
I combine the crystals in a tungsten titanium matrix at supercool temperatures. That's what did the trick.
The applications for this, it's...
What do you call this material?
Well, its real name has 37 syllables. I call it unobtainium.
Yeah. Unobtainium.
Mm-hmm.
The unobtainium will take the heat and the pressure and transform it to energy, which in turn reinforces the shell of the ship, you see. So the hotter and the deeper she gets, the stronger she gets, theoretically.
Theoretically,
yes.
Wait, this! There's Johnson, don't mind him. This is the prototype for the cockpit here. Excuse me, Dr. Brazelton, when do you think the ship will be operational? When I get my fabrication methods perfected, 10 years.
What would it take to get it done in 3 months?
$50 billion.
Will you take a check? I should use a credit card to get miles. Mm.
So you've got the ship. Now, the other thing that Braz brings to the game is the fact that he's created a way to punch through rock really well and really fast. It's a combination of lasers to melt the rock and ultrasonics to break it up and to scatter the fragments of the rock. So he's got an enormous, basically, death ray, which they're going to mount on the front of the ship, bore into the Earth, and there's technically no limit to where they can go. And that's the core of this film, boom. And one of the things that I like about it, and which is said in the extras on the DVD, by the way, is that this harks back to your 1960s science fiction adventure films. Things like Fantastic Voyage. It's even got a little bit of crack in the world to it as well. But basically, you know, you get the team together and then you do something really remarkable. And usually it's something space based, but this is the opposite. You're going into the Earth to save the Earth rather than going out and doing an Armageddon or a Deep Impact to rescue the Earth from an asteroid of some kind. Now, given that there are scientific inaccuracies in this film, and if you can just kind of step over that particular pile of dog shit, it's a good, solid adventure flick. They do successfully put the ship together, and there are problems with yeah, the discipline of the crew. You've got six people in the crew who are all individuals, and two of them are professional astronauts. The rest of them are just mad scientists, pretty much, in various ways. Getting the cohesion among the crew. Josh comes up with a way to use magnetic resonance imaging so they can have a radar view ahead of the ship and know what's happening. And eventually they go to the Marianas Trench off the coast of the Philippines and basically dive deep into the earth. While back on land, Rat, played by G.J. Qualls, starts basically suppressing any news of the disasters that are happening so that there isn't a planetary panic and basically people rip things down before they can be destroyed by natural causes anyway. And he's a lot of fun too. I mean, you know, DJ Qualls is not the prettiest actor. He's a skinny little geek with an enormous nose and jug ears. But he's right for the role and he has a lot of fun talking about getting Xena tapes and Star Trek tapes and Hot Pockets and basically hacking the planet, which is a kind of a conceit. But it works, and it does have a payoff at the end of the film too, which is a recognition of the bravery of the crew. Now, so they go in there. There's a few really great action sequences. The ship known as Virgil, who of course is the guy who descended into hell in Dante's Inferno, basically pierces an enormous geode about roughly the size of, I don't know, Connecticut. And they get stuck with a giant amethyst crystal jammed up the front of the ship. And they've got to get out in the intense heat of where they are and basically cut it loose. Now, there is a bit missing from the film where they talk a bit more about the suits they've got where they can go out in extreme high temperatures. The suits are woven with unobtainium, and it's in the extras, the missing scene, talking about that. The missing scene's kind of cool because they're testing the suits and trying them on and that kind of thing. And Braz hits Zimsky with a flamethrower just to show how cool the suit is and how fireproof and heatproof it is, which kind of is a nice funny bit. But there wasn't really room for it in the tight structure of the movie, so they've thrown it in the extras on the DVD. But these suits become really important later on as the thing progresses, and they find out that their plan to restart the core with a nuke isn't going to work, and they've got to think of a different way to do it. And that way requires enormous sacrifice from several of the characters. Now, there are some deaths in the film. I'm not going to say who, because I'm not going to do any more spoilers than the trailer already did. But the characters, and particularly one of them, one of the deaths involving extreme heat, really is touching because we've kind of grown to like the character. And he's an interesting part of the ensemble, and his death matters. And I think that that's probably one of the things about this film that's really the great virtue that it has, in that you do care for the characters. You've got Josh, who's incredibly out of his depth, and yet they make him the head of the project. He's basically a university lecturer who's very good with students and very knowledgeable in that. And then suddenly they put him in charge of a multi-billion dollar project to save the whole planet. And he really does feel it. And all credit to Aaron Eckhart, who I think is a very underrated actor, for bringing across that kind of geek out of his depth aspect of it. You got Hilary Swank playing a super competent astronaut who basically has the problem of never having failed before this scenario comes along and having to deal with the aftermath of that. You've got Zimsky, who's a smoker and he's not allowed to smoke inside Virgil, so, and an old rivalry between him and Brazelton, Delroy Lindo's character, where Zimsky is accused of having stolen some of Braz's work in the past, and there's a tension between them and a professional rivalry between them. And you got Serge Levesque, who basically is a Frenchman, and who goes on this mission not to save the world, but to save his wife and children. And that's the heart of it for him is, you know, he can't encompass in his mind saving the world, but he can encompass saving his family. And that's the angle that he comes at it from. And I think it's very important because it does kind of bring what they're doing down to human size. The fact that this one man just wants to save his family. And they carry that on as a part of their kind of mission plan almost. Save Serge's family. And I kind of like that. It's not perfect. There are a couple of problems with a few of the special effects in the film, but I do like the fact that they did at least try to, within this enormous plot of saving the world, really getting to the heart of human beings and trying and caring at least as much for the characters as they do for the effects and for the action sequences, of which there are some great ones in this film. So that's about what I can say about the film. Just to summarize, I think that intention, whether you agree whether it's successful or not, that intention of having a character-based science fiction action film on this scale is an honourable one. And I like the fact that they did regard the characters highly enough to get a very fine ensemble cast to portray them. Now, this film, of course, can be seen as a prototype for any number of Sci-Fi Channel movies that have followed. There are probably 50 or 100 movies that follow the same basic premise of the core. And the Sci-Fi Channel and the Asylum, particularly, pump these suckers out at literally one a week for most of the year. And a lot of them do follow the arc that has been set for them by the films, of course, before this one, but particularly from the core. But what they don't have going for them is that real strong cast. So, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about the course. Some people like it, but most of the people I've talked to have said that it's a shit movie, but I kind of disagree. I think that I've seen it 5 times now, maybe. It turns up on TV regularly, and I get sucked into watching it when it does as I'm channel surfing. But I still like the characters, and I do like the action sequences, and I do like the fact that even the military guy played by Richard Jenkins, who had a big hand in Project Destiny along with Zimsky, are treated as intelligent people. They've got conflicting viewpoints and they've got conflicting agendas. But nobody's one of those kind of straw dummy idiots that some films put up as a way of having an antagonist in the piece. Even Richard Jenkins' character, the general, is an honourable man by his own lights. And he does, at a couple of times, say a few things to boost people up. While he's a military man and very much focused on that, an actor of the calibre of Richard Jenkins does bring a humanity to him, which is kind of nice. So just to summarise, the science is a bit wonky. It could have been fixed in the scripting. There's nothing innately fucked up that would really make this an impossible-to-fix science fiction film. And the characters are great. I like the adventure. I like the fact that they hacked the planet. And it's a film that I do have a lot of fondness for. It harks back to the films I saw as a child. And really, I think it's very underrated in that regard. So I'm going to take a break and probably have another espresso, which is what I do on weekends pretty much. Watch movies, drink espressos, hang out with people. And when I get back, I'm going to go into the deep, dark history of science fiction films and do a film a year recommendation.
enjoy movies like Carnival of Souls, The Mole People, Black Sunday, and The Tingler? Do you find yourself late at night reading magazines such as Film Max, Chiller Theater, or Monster Bash? Do you love vintage television programs like Sky King, Outer Limits, and The Time Tunnel? Do you find yourself surfing the net looking for the next Monster Movie Festival or Expo? Do you enjoy hearing anecdotes, cinematic details, and unusual insights into some of your favorite movies? If you answered yes to any of the above, you are encouraged to join your host, Vince Rotolo, as he examines some of the latest horror, sci-fi, and cult theatrical releases, new DVDs to add to your collection, and of course, the old classics, both good and bad. He even interviews people throughout B-Moviedom. So tune into B-MovieCast at bmoviecast.com.
Resistance is futile.
Nothing ever happens on Mars. No sports or entertainment or strange in bars. You stand around, you stand some more on the planet named for a Roman god of war.
Okay, it's time for news from the planet Mars, and there is some. Our old friend Curiosity found out something interesting about Curiosity rover. It's a bit more terrestrial, this interesting thing, but there is a Twitter feed for the Curiosity rover. It's at Mars, capital M, capital C, Curiosity. And I've sent Curiosity a Twitter message and saying basically that there are a lot of fans of the Mars Curiosity rover here at Mars Drive-In Podcast. Haven't got a reply yet, but on the other hand, it is 48 million miles away. Though, to be honest with you, the Twitter feed comes from a bunch of the scientists who basically run the Mars Curiosity rover, and they occasionally answer the tweets, and they do produce some as well when there's a bit of news. And I thought that was kind of cute. It's got, you know, my mum's a lot closer than Mars, and she doesn't have a Twitter feed, but then she doesn't have a computer either, for that matter. But I thought that was rather cute, and I'm quite glad that Mars Curiosity is very much a part of social media. Now, there is some other news as well, which is only just today's news, and it's quite interesting. Mars Curiosity has found something on Mars that looks like a doorknob or a door handle or a robot's fingers or something sticking up out of a rock layer. Now, I'm going to post a picture of this weird object on the marsdrivein.blogspot.com webpage, but they tend to think that it's something that it's a little bit harder than the other soil, so it hasn't worn away as much, but it looks really fucking freaky. It's literally kind of like a protuberance sticking up through the dirt layers. So Mars keeps throwing up weird stuff like that for us all, and it's just really, really weird that every time Curiosity wanders around, something else weird is found. I mean, they've found a bit more evidence of water, and now they've found this weird thing which somebody on Boing Boing has said looks like the Dukes of Hazzard's car leaping over a ravine. It's shiny, and it's really an unusual little something. And I hope they do find out what it is, because I'm dying to know. It's a really weird little artifact that they found there. So that's pretty much the news from Mars. You can, if you type in Mars news into Google, you can get tons of this sort of stuff. And it's all really interesting. Even though Curiosity has travelled maybe a kilometre or so since it started off, it just keeps finding weird and wonderful shit, and the colour pictures that are coming through are such high resolution that you think there'd be there was somebody walking around with a high-end smartphone just taking pictures of things. The resolution really is awesome compared to, for instance, the early stuff we got from other probes in the late 70s and the 80s. It's just beautifully rich, and it gives you just such a rich feel for the texture of the planet that I recommend that people just keep looking at those web pages and finding out what a cool place Mars is. So that's about it for the Mars news. I will keep you updated next time around. But now on to my little unexpected project of recommending one movie for every year since 1930. Now, the trick here is just imagine, which I podcasted about a couple of podcasts ago, it's from 1930. So I've got 1930 well and truly covered. Just go back and listen to Mars Driving podcast number 9, I think it was. And you will find out my recommendation for the year 1930. So we're getting on to 1931's quite easy as well. It's maybe the simplest year for me to pick a movie from. And just going to play a little bit of audio from that movie.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. In the name of God. Now I know what it feels like to be God.
Yep, we're talking James Whale's 1931 Frankenstein. I could have gone with Dracula, but Frankenstein was much, much cooler. And I always thought, and disagree with me if you like, Boris Karloff as a person and as an actor was much, much cooler than Bela Lugosi. I don't give a fuck if Martin Landau got an Oscar for playing him. Karloff was the man. Just check out Isle of the Dead he did with Val Lewton if you want a good example of the better work that he's done. Really, Lugosi's nothing compared to Karloff. And if I get some feedback on that, too damn bad, because it happens to be the truth. So we move on to 1932. I've actually got my book here, The Overlook Film Encyclopedia, edited by Phil Hardy, which is useful because it does go year by year through science fiction films. And you got 1932. I've actually done that one as well. What do you know? Island of Lost Souls. Okay, I was wrong. That one was in Martian Driving podcast number 9. The Just Imagine was in Martian Driving podcast number 8, so I misspoke that. So I could go with Island of Lost Souls. Second choice on that one, I think, is a pre-code movie. I would go with the Frederick March, Miriam Hopkins version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as my second choice for 1932. I've got it on a double DVD along with the Spencer Tracy version. I'm watching them back-to-back. They are both excellent adaptations and are highly recommended for your delectation. So that brings us to 1933, which I've got choices here as well. And these torrents are out there if you're interested. The first one I'd go with is The Invisible Man, which is very cool, Claude Rains, and which always reminds me of Son of the Invisible Man from Amazon Women on the Moon. But Invisible Man, definitely great. And it's in that great new Universal Horror box set on Blu-ray if you want to pick that up. But my second choice is the German movie. Oh, look, I've just checked it out. There's more choices. You could go to The Testament of Dr. Mabuse if you wanted to as well. But the choice I'd go with, which I just watched on DVD, is Der Tunnel from 1933, which was made in an English language version in 1935, oddly enough called The Tunnel, which is about a transatlantic tunnel. But this is the earlier version. The remake was made by Maurice Elvey in Britain in 1935, but this version was directed by Kurt Bernhardt, and I like it kind of more than the English language version in some ways. It's really darker, and it's still got a little bit of that German impressionistic look about it. But that one's recommended. If you're on Cinemageddon, and if you don't know what that is, you probably aren't, there is a torrent of it on Cinemageddon, which you can download with English subtitles. And I recommend that you do that because it is very much worth watching. So we're talking now 1934. And to be honest with you, there's not a lot in 1934. I'm not sure what happened there. But I'm looking through it and I can't see anything that really grabs me. So I'm going to skip 1934. And then 1935, you got the choice of The Bride of Frankenstein. Of course, again, James Whale, which I highly recommend. Or you've got the other one, which is Mad Love, also known as The Hands of Orlok. I know that the B-movie cast has done that movie. And I recommend it as well. Peter Lorre in that, fantastic. Peter Lorre again, much cooler than Bela Lugosi. And I would check that one out because it is seriously freaky shit. Brought Lorre to the attention of English-speaking audiences as a freaky little fucker.
I, a poor peasant, have conquered science. Why can't I conquer love? He shall be shut up when it's I who am mad. But nobody knows that. Yes, each man kills the thing he loves.
Which brings us to 1936, and you can't get past Things to Come. Really, it's H.G. Wells' vision of the future. It's very prophetic about World War II. It goes a lot further than World War II did, unfortunately. And really, it's got a few other points about it which are interesting, including the fact that it shows you, maybe the first time in cinema, a post-apocalyptic society where civilization's been thrown back to the Middle Ages over most of the world. And that's quite interesting that that trope first appeared there. So I definitely recommend that one because it's a classic of the genre. And the other thing is, if you go to YouTube, the whole film is available for you to download and watch at your leisure. Classic of science fiction genre and really interesting as well. Budgets were large for an English film at the time, and it all shows up there on the screen. William Cameron Menzies did a great job on that one. 37. We've got another movie that's available on YouTube, I've just found out, and I've talked about it on a fairly early Paleo Cinema podcast, and that is Q-Planes, which is also known as Clouds Over Europe. It's kind of a proto-James Bond film in a lot of ways. It stars Sir Ralph Richardson, Laurence Olivier's in there, Valerie Hobson in it as well. And the most curious thing about it is that Jack Whittingham, who later on went to write Thunderball as a James Bond film, was one of the script writers on Q-Planes, which is a lot of fun. Ralph Richardson's a hoot in it. And there's a ship with a ray that can stop aeroplanes from flying and basically cuts their engines and all sorts of other little bits of shenanigans. It's quite a lot of fun. 1938 doesn't have a lot unless you like Flash Gordon, which I don't particularly. I think even for the time it was pretty stupid. Almost as stupid as 1939's Buck Rogers. The old joke being Buck Rogers, who doesn't? But 1939 wasn't all that bad for a couple of other reasons. There are a few other films that were a little more interesting, including Son of Frankenstein, of course. But the one I'd really go with is the one real horror movie that Humphrey Bogart made, The Return of Dr. X, where Bogart has a white streak in his hair and plays a freaky doctor. And it's a sequel to Dr. X from 1932, which I haven't seen yet. But it stars Dennis Morgan, Wayne Morris, Rosemary Lane, and Olin Howard. But that one's interesting because seeing Bogart in a totally different role before, just a little tiny bit before he became the Humphrey Bogart that we know and revere, is a bit of fun. I think he's miscast to hell, but it's nice. There are times when you really get as much enjoyment out of seeing a miscast and slightly off film that you do about seeing a reasonably good one. Just having, just that weirdness is an attraction to, fucked up film buffs like myself. So we get on to 1940.
As you and your fellows develop toward normal size, you will again interfere with my work. And that is something which I cannot permit.
Yep, it's Dr. Cyclops. You've got to go with Dr. Cyclops on this one. Directed by Ernest B. Schroedsack, starring Albert Dekker as Dr. Thor Kell, who's working in the South American jungle with a radioactive element that glows beautifully green in the Technicolor and has found a way to shrink people down to small size. And it's an interesting film, not the least because Albert Dekker himself was a bit twisted and died in the 1960s of autoerotic strangulation. But leaving that aside, you've got the one of the great early shrunken down people movies. There was, of course, Devil Doll and things like that with Lionel Barrymore in drag from the mid-30s. But Dr. Cyclops, if you have a look at it, the Technicolor is beautifully vivid. And the story's pretty good, too. It's a lot of fun. And I like it a lot more than I like a lot of other shrunken down people fighting against big human being kind of movies. With the possible exception, of course, of the Incredible Shrinking Man, which is in a league of its own, really. But 1940 was good for that one. There were a couple of other things. There was The Invisible Woman and The Invisible Man Returns. Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe. But 1941, you've got the Americans coming into World War II. And you then have the 1941 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which has Spencer Tracy and Ingrid Bergman in it. This one's very psychosexual and really worth, as I said, back-to-backing with the earlier Frederick March version. It holds up really well. It's a bit of a departure for the actor playing the main role, in this case Spencer Tracy, and I think it really works. It's good, solid, and worth revisiting. I haven't done it in a long time, so I'm going to have to make a note of that. Looking through this list, I'm just seeing movies that I want to revisit, and I'm not going to be able to do it for a while because I just got a cold of a whole bunch of Bud Boudica westerns that I haven't seen yet. So that's next on my list of things to see, is go through the 5 Bud Boudica westerns I haven't seen. But I'm digressing a little bit. So we're talking 1942 now. And the war wasn't particularly kind to science fiction. There were still some Universal horror films coming through, but people were really not quite as involved in the genre that we know and love. So 1942, what do we have? There's a movie called The Boogeyman Will Get You with Peter Lorre in it. I haven't seen that, but I would like to. Ghost of Frankenstein, The Invisible Agent, King of the Mounties. There wasn't really a hell of a lot there to play with. So we get into 1943, and you got the first version of Batman in 1943, the one that starred Lewis Wilson and Douglas Crofton, had J. Carroll Nash as the villain. It was a movie serial, of course, and very early Batman stuff, but it'd be a lot of fun to watch this first Batman serial. I don't have it. I have the sequel to it from a couple of years later, Batman and Robin, the movie serial, but I don't have this one. It'd be interesting to back-to-back that with the latest, one of the Christian Bale ones, just to see how much the character has changed and moved along with the times. But again, going to original sources is something I like to do, and I do like the early ones. There was and then we get to 1944, and there was a Captain America serial, 15 chapters done by Republic. Wouldn't mind seeing that either. If anybody can hook me up with that one, I'd be very interested to do it. Yeah, then you've got, but the takeaway films from that year of 1944, House of Frankenstein, which is very cool, as indeed were a lot of the Universal horror films. Let me see if there's anything else. There is one I haven't seen for a very long time. I've got to find a copy of it. It was an English comedy called Time Flies, which starred Tommy Handley, Evelyn Dahl, and George Moon, and Felix Aylmer as a mad scientist with a time machine. They go back to Elizabethan times. And I've seen it once on late night television, but I'm going to have to try to hook that one up again, because English science fiction films of any kind, even ridiculous little comedies like this one, were kind of rare. It wasn't a time when there was a lot of spare money around. Most of the money was going into the war effort. But they did have time to make it. And I think it's one of the very few science fiction films that Gainsborough made. So I'm going to have to make a note of that one as well. Let me see. 1945, end of the war. Again, everybody was making war films, so there wasn't a lot happening with the genre. But probably House of Dracula would be the one. It's played a little bit tongue-in-cheek. Lon Chaney Jr., Angela Stevenson, John Carradine, Lionel Atwill, Glenn Strange, Jane Addams. Again, I haven't seen that one for a long time, so I'm going to have to troll the interwebs and see what I can locate on that, because It looks like it's a lot of fun. It says here, House of Dracula opens bizarrely with Chaney's Wolfman and Carradine's Dracula arriving at the house of Mad Dr. Stevens in search of cures. Stevens cures Chaney, but in the process of giving blood to Dracula, he receives the vampire's infected blood, and after disposing of John Carradine, who quickly reverses the type, he becomes a monster himself. So, yep, that one would definitely be the go-to movie for 1945. So we got 1946, and there's absolutely nothing. Absolutely zero with the rim removed. 1947 is pretty much the same way. But 1948, you get the first Superman serial, which is kind of interesting. That's the one with Kirk Allen, where the Superman flying bits are actually animated. I've got a copy of that one. I've watched about half of it, and it is quite interesting. You've got Noel Neill, who was Lois Lane in the Adventures of Superman series with George Reeves for a while, and Tommy Bond's in it. Let's see, nobody else really big, but because it's the first Superman serial, it's interesting to watch, and Superman's more athletic than he is super powerful in this one, because Kirk Allen, the guy who played him, was a dancer originally. But it's definitely worth checking out and seeing how they overcame the special effects limitations and, of course, budgetary limitations, being a fairly low-budget film. It's done by Columbia Pictures. But I like it. I do, and I kind of like Kirk Allen as Superman. He's a different version of it. Very, very different from Henry Cavill, of course, but well worth checking out if you've got the time and the availability. So you've got some choices for 1949, but the one I'm going to go with is an English comedy made by Two Cities called The Perfect Woman, where Miles Mallison creates a robot woman indistinguishable from his niece, played by Patricia Rock. Nigel Patrick's in it as well. Irene Handel's in it. And they kind of get the two mixed up, the girl and the robot, and it's a fairly light bit of fluff, but a little bit interesting, and I always like character actors like Miles Mallison in movies, and Irene Handel's always good value. But if you haven't seen that one, it is available, but I'm not sure whether the DVD version is out of print or not. One way or the other, you know how to find things these days. Saying things are out of print a little bit redundant the way the internet works. And so that brings us into the 1950s, which in a lot of ways was very much the heyday of science fiction film. And 1950, you've got Adam Man vs. Superman, you've got Destination Moon, you've got a movie called The Flying Saucer. I think that's the one with Dan Duryea in it, is it? No, it doesn't have Dan Duryea in it. I'm thinking of The Bamboo Saucer. But there's a movie called The Flying Saucer. Rocket Ship XM, probably the one to go to would be...
Come and take a trip in my rocket ship. We'll have a lovely afternoon. Kiss the world goodbye and away we fly. Destination Moon.
Yeah, you've got to go to Destination Moon for a couple of reasons, one of which is it was based on a story by Robert Heinlein, which makes it very much in the heartland of science fiction. And also, it was the first of George Powell's big science fiction movies, and you've got to give it props for that. And it tried to be as scientifically accurate as it could. It tried to very much be really realistic kind of science fiction film, and respected the genre. So for those reasons alone, it's well worth our consideration. Now, having a look at the time on this podcast, I'm going to stop at 1955 for now, and then next time around when I'm with Nick Sauer, we'll probably hit from 55 to 75, and then the subsequent episode will go from 75 onwards. But 1951, I'm going to avoid the obvious on this one. 1951, the obvious choice will be The Day the Earth Stood Still, which gets a lot of respect for a lot of good reasons. Dead solid, a lot of fun, really great acting by Patricia Neal, the guy in the robot suit, and, of course, Michael Rennie. But the one I'd go for, and to be honest with you, there's a wealth of choices here. You could even go for The Thing from Another World, which was 1951. See, the 50s were, as I said, such a rich playground for us there. You could even go When Worlds Collide, which would be kind of cool, but I'm not going to go for either of those. I'm going to go with The Man in the White Suit from Ealing Studios, 1951. Alec Guinness inventing a cloth that repels water and never gets dirty, never wears out, and a whole bunch of different conflicting people in a mill town in England get a bit upset with the fact that there's not going to be an ongoing need for their product. It's satirical. It's a lot of fun. It was actually one of the last films that Ernest Thesiger, who played Dr. Pretorius in The Bride of Frankenstein, appeared in. And he's quite fun. And again, Miles Mallison's in it. Joan Greenwood is very sexy in this film. And it's just a joy the way that pretty much every Ealing film is. The entertainment strike rate on Ealing films was higher than maybe any other studio. The quality was just fantastic and always a lot of fun. So that brings us to 1952, with the obvious choice here, which, as anybody would know, is Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla, where the really awful Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin impersonators Mitchell and Petrillo, Duke Mitchell and Sammy Petrillo, appear. I've actually tried to watch that three times and haven't succeeded yet. Let me just see. I could go Red Planet Mars, but I don't like the religious aspects of that. It's just totally icky from my point of view. Zombies of the Stratosphere, one of the first roles of Leonard Nimoy in there, so we could give that one props if we wanted to. I'm going with the Republic serial this time, and that is Radar Men on the Moon, which was the sequel to King of the Rocket Men and Commander Captain Cody, Sky Marshal of the Universe. It's really cheap, and it's about a guy with a rocket suit jetpack. Think early diesel punk rocketeer kind of thing. Again, they had the dummy on wires going down the valley in every second shot to portray the guy with the suit. The controls for the rocket jetpack were on the chest of the thing, so you couldn't actually see them when you were using them. But in spite of that, I kind of like it. I did see that a lot when I was a little kid. And so Radar Men on the Moon, which I liked a lot, is my choice for 1952. 53 is easier. 53, I'm not even going to look at the rest of the films. I'm not going to go Abbott and Costello Go to Mars or Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I'm going straight to The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms because I remember seeing this really early in my life. I stayed up late and I watched it with my mum on late night television. Of course, this is one of the early Harryhausen special effects bits. Kenneth Toby, Cecil Kellaway, Paul Christian, Paula Raymond, Lee Van Cleef's in it as well. Giant Dinosaur, Streets of New York, what's not to like there? It's a lot of fun. And the one thing I remember about it, apart from seeing the dinosaur tied up in the roller coaster and then getting burnt down, was my mum was really sad that the dinosaur died, and she felt very sorry for it. And I kind of remember that many, many, many years later. And for that reason, I've kind of got a great fondness for The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. In fact, when I was a teenager, I had the poster for the movie on my wall. We could have gone with a few other choices. Donovan's Brain with Lou Ayres was one of the choices, another classic science fiction film. An early Hammer science fiction film would have been another choice, The Four-Sided Triangle, which I think I've talked about on a Paleo Cinema podcast. Could have gone Invaders from Mars, It Came from Outer Space, The Magnetic Monster. It gets even better. Phantom of Space, Project Moonbase, which was kind of interesting. It's in public domain if you're interested in that one. Again, it's based on a bit of Robert Heinlein and kind of very, very Heinlein in some ways. I've even talked about that on a podcast, come to think of it. The Twonky would have been another option. Let me see here. Or the George Powell War of the Worlds, though, again, and this is very much a personal bias, and if it offends you, excuse me. But the religious bits about the bacteria destroying the Martians in War of the Worlds puts me off. I think that, so I've got this thing in my head that science fiction should be secular. It's not always, and I don't really think it should be, but there's a subconscious shunning of religious stuff in science fiction for me. And it may be a flaw in my character, but it's there, and I've got an awareness of it. So that brings us to 1954, and I could have gone with Mickey Rooney's science fiction film of 1954 being The Atomic Kid, which was on TV all the time when I was little. And Mickey Rooney and Robert Strauss go out to a nuclear testing range, and they're prospectors, and they've been very unlucky. And so they go out and walk into a house, and there's food in the house, so they decide to have a meal. And unfortunately, Mickey Rooney gets nuked, but it doesn't kill him. And he becomes a celebrity because he's apparently nuclear-proof. Very much a Cold War comedy, and doesn't have anything at all to do with the realities of nuclear weapons. But that thing was on TV all the time when I was a kid. 54 was also good for things like The Creature from the Black Lagoon, total classic. GOG, Ivan Tor's effort, which was done in 3D and stars Richard Egan and Herbert Marshall. If you get a chance to see GOG, it's very scientifically cool. It does very much have that diesel punk vibe to it. And it's in, again, very vivid colour. Gojira, I think, was 1954 as well, which is kind of cool. But the one I'm going to go for, basically for fetishistic reasons, is Devil Girl from Mars, the English movie, which was based on a play, oddly enough. And, of course, you've got the Hazel Courts in it, Patricia Laffin playing the Devil Girl from Mars. You've got a really cool robot. You've got a really funky-looking spaceship. And Adrian Corey's in it as well. And an actor called Peter Reynolds, who Australians might know more than anybody else. Because in the 60s and 70s, Peter Reynolds was in Australian television and did ads for a brand of cigarette called Wild Woodbines, amongst anything else. They stopped the ads pretty soon after he died from smoking in bed. But Peter Reynolds is in it playing a runaway criminal, so I always associate that movie with smoking for some odd reason. So that brings us to the last one I'm going to look at this podcast around, being 1955. And again, 50s being atomic everything. I could have even gone with Them or 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, so that's even better. But 1955, let me have a look. Quite a mass experiment. You got hands down, quite a mass experiment. Could have gone with Kiss Me Deadly. Could have gone with Revenge of the Creature. Could have gone with King Dinosaur, which is horrible. But the quite a mass experiment, also known as the Creeping Unknown Hammer film, first of the movie adaptations of the Quatermass stories with Brian Donlevy, who's not my favourite Quatermass at all. I kind of like Andre Morel in the TV, or else Andrew Keir. They're my favourite Quatermasses. But again, really iconic science fiction film, and well worth checking out if you haven't already. And I'm not sure whether Hammickus have done it yet, or 1951 Down Place, but if they haven't, they really should. I haven't looked it up, but I really should have. But anyway, that's it. That's where I'm going to leave things for this time around. We've got from 1930s to 1955, which is a pretty good run. So I'm going to take another break now and have a drink. And when I get back, there is feedback, and I will inflict it on you.
Discovered an important note from space. The Martians plan to throw a dance for all the human race.
On the floor, attention to the sound.
That was the Randells with The Martian Hop, one of their signature tunes for the Martian Drive-In podcast, of course. Now, on to the feedback. The first bit we got is from Dave Brandt, which appears at the Martian Drive-In podcast website. It's actually posted to Paleo Cinema Podcast, but I'll get it over there. It's from Dave Brandt, and Dave says, I found a couple of cool videos that are relevant to the 4D Man. He's talking about the 4D Man podcast number 3, the 4D Idiocracy. The first one is www.minutephysics.com. Has a little mind-bending lesson in physics that's directly relevant. It's the old turkey about the immovable object versus the unstoppable force. So if you go over to the Paleo Cinema website, you'll see Dave's comment on that. Actual physicists, he says, have started to take this idea of a hyperdimensional universe seriously. This stuff is a lot more far-fetched than the movie. Here's a serious talk by Brian Greene at TED, about either the current state of cosmology or science fiction. He's got some cool visuals of the supposedly hyperdimensional universe. So if you go over to Paleo Cinema podcast blog, which is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com, you can check that out. The only catch, says Dave, is that the universe is hyperdimensional only down to the Planck length, which is really small. I think it would be very cool to remake 4D Man, but with current cosmology as a starting point. It would be a sort of combination of 4D Man and Fantastic Voyage that would shrink the actress playing the Raquel Welch part down to the Planck length so she could explore hyperspace, a bit like Alice in Wonderland. Yeah, thanks for that, Dave. Physics is weirder than science fiction in a lot of ways these days. And, of course, even space exploration, as the little odd object on the planet Mars at the moment indicates, is a lot weirder than a lot of the stuff that we've thought up for the genre. And, I do like the TED. If you go to TED, they've got short talks. I think they're supposed to be 17 minutes or less. I could be wrong. From basically experts on every field around. They're kind of crash courses, bite-sized chunks on the current thinking in a lot of fields to do with scientific, particularly scientific advancement. And you could spend all day just watching TED lectures and the whole day's gone. That they are the best of the best and they're all free on the web. And really, I've watched a few of them. I watched Temple Grandin's talk, for instance, which is very interesting, and a couple of others. And they're just mind-blowingly fantastic. So if you go to www.ted.com, and beware, you're going to need a lot of time to do this. I'm just looking at their page now. They've got Lee Cronin talking about print your own medicine, for instance, and a guy called Eddie Rama saying, take back your city with paint. He's talking about graffiti there. And just incredible people talking about incredible things all the time. It's one of those websites that sucks you in and doesn't let you go if you let it. And you really do have to be careful about time management once you find a website like that, because it will definitely take away all of your time. So thanks for that, Dave. Let's see what else we have here. Yep, we have an email from David Cummo in the Tropical Paradise Human Beings called Minneapolis. It says, hey Terry, David Cummo here in snowy Minnesota. I am at this very instant listening to the episode number 10 and just have to put in my 2 cents worth about The Road. The movie was bad enough, but I absolutely hated the book. Why? Because it had no quotation marks, long stretches of dialogue, no quotation marks. I was ranting about The Road in my book club and someone said, oh, the writer was making an artistic choice. Maybe so, I said. But if the dimwit decides to use improper grammar and then make it harder for me to read and understand, then he's making a bone-dead stupid choice. Artistic choice, my ass. And let me just end by saying that listening to both your podcasts is far from dead stupid. Take care and say hi to Sal for me, David. Thanks for that, David. David and I actually met way back in 98 when I was in Minneapolis. And he's a lovely guy. And thank you for listening to the podcast, David. And I hope you continue to do so. It's really nice to have an overseas listener whom I've met. Tyranny of Distance being what it is. Yeah, but thank you very much.
Hey, Terry, this is Richard from Wichita, calling in with some thoughts and comments on the most recent episode of the Martian Drive-In podcast. First off, got to say, great to hear your guest host or guest co-host or co-host or however you want to word it, Nick. Great hearing him. You know, I'm loving his blog, Fantastic Television. He is the go-to guru of genre television information. I really enjoy hearing his comments, and because I follow his blog and listen to him over at the B Movie Cast. So great to hear him on your show, and I think you guys had a great discussion. Babylon 5, you know, I was a follower of this show from the get-go, back in the 90s when it first aired, and being a lover of Star Trek and Doctor Who, I was always open to new sci-fi, but I was always very critical of it. It really had to be good because I was, you know, following probably two of the most popular sci-fi shows in television history. And so if I was going to follow another one, it really had to be up there. And Babylon 5 wasn't perfect, but I, you know, really enjoyed it from, you know, beginning to end throughout its run. This was a show that didn't fire on all cylinders when it started off. The first season was a little rough around the edges. But, you know, some other shows are that way, too. I look at the first season of Star Trek The Next Generation, which I'm currently rewatching on Blu-ray. It's pretty rough. It's pretty rough. The characters are still in development. You see some things from the characters that you're not going to see later on. And a lot of television shows are like that. Very few shows are so structured that they immediately are firing on all cylinders from the first episode, and they don't go through any period of change or tweaking. Babylon 5, you know, made some changes after that first season, and the addition of Bruce Boxleitner, I think, really enhanced the show. I think seasons 2, 3, and 4 were just knocking it out of the park. They definitely, you know, had an idea. Straczynski had an idea of what he wanted to accomplish, and I thought that they accomplished it very well. The fifth season, which was the season that wasn't supposed to happen, you know, but then ended up doing it the last minute, I always felt was a little bit anticlimactic. It just, it seemed like they had everything structured to wrap up at the end of that fourth season. And then it just seemed like, oh, wait a minute, we're going to go with some more episodes here. I liked it. I liked it. It always kind of felt a little, I don't know, just a little tacked on. And then, of course, I think the finale was great, but it felt like it should have happened a year earlier. So there was a little bit of unevenness there towards the end. Wasn't a fan of Crusade. I did watch the reunion movies or spinoff movies or however you want to word that. I always thought that the special effects, they went really cheap, I thought, on it, and I wasn't too impressed with the movies that followed. I've met several of the cast. You know, they tapped into a lot of different sci-fi genres. I mean, Bill Mumy as Lanier, obviously tapping into Lost in Space. You had Walter Koenig as Bester, tapping into the Star Trek audience. I've had an opportunity to meet several of these people, and I was very, very impressed. First and foremost, Tracy Scoggins, who played the character of Captain Elizabeth Lockley, met her down at Trek Expo. She was stunningly beautiful, but she was also just an extreme professional. She was there for the, I think it was one day. I don't think she was even there for 2 days. And she had the flu. She was traveling with her mom, and yet she still managed to get on stage a little late. She still signed some autographs. She was incredibly pleasant, knowing that she wasn't at 100%. That particular year was a year I was there with my family, my little kids at the time, and she was just incredibly nice to them and went out of her way to talk to them, which impressed me greatly. So meeting her was really one of the highlights of all my years and of all the people I've met down at Trek Expo. Bruce Boxleitner was great to meet. You know, didn't have the outstanding experience like I had with Tracy Scoggins, but he was very nice, very pleasant. Sometimes they're not when they're signing the autographs. He genuinely wanted to be there, and I know some other people had a lot of great conversations with him. And I did meet Walter Koenig, so I guess we'll mention him. I met him primarily because of Mr. Chekov from Star Trek, and unfortunately when I met him, he was a little bit of a grumpy guest. So not the best experience there. He wasn't horrible, but I think he was just kind of tired and didn't really want to be there when I got him to sign the autograph. So in any case, great discussion on Babylon 5. Loved hearing you guys talk about it. That show came at a time in the 1990s when first run syndication was just incredibly huge here in the States. You're not going to get that type of science fiction anymore. That was kind of, it's kind of a dying breed. Anything you get like that now is going to be held to tighter restrictions as far as networks and ratings. And the first run syndication allowed a lot of shows to run longer than they would today. So great discussion there. I don't have really anything to share in regards to Buckaroo Banzai. It is one of those movies from the 1980s that I missed. Have no clue, no explanation. I've heard people talk about it on other podcasts before, and it's been on my radar for a while, but I found this thing. It's on Netflix streaming, so it is now at the top of my queue, and I hope to be watching it within the next, I'm going to say next couple of weeks. I've got kind of a short stack of stuff I want to watch the next couple of weeks, but it's going to be viewed. So when I watch it, if I have any additional comments, I will call and let you know. Otherwise, you know, from what I know and from your conversation about it, yeah, I think I'm going to enjoy it. I don't know why I didn't see it when it was originally out. I know it's hard to find on DVD. You find a DVD copy, you're going to be, it's been out of print for a while. So unless they put it back in print, I know when I checked a while back, copies were going for like $40 a pop. So, which was more than I wanted to pay for a movie that I hadn't really seen and didn't quite know if I was going to enjoy it or not. Netflix streaming, yeah, it's part of the $7.95 a month that I pay for it, so yeah, it's the perfect price. I'll let you know if I have any comments on it. With that, as always, I'm loving the show. Take care, and we will talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Let me know what you think about Buckaroo Banzai. I think it's very much an artifact of its time, but it's still not without interest, and there's a strong nostalgia that a lot of people have for it, which is which makes it a lot of fun as well. Science fiction movies of the past have various types of charm, and having said that, there's a pussycat at the door that I've got to let in, otherwise she's going to meow and destroy the podcast. Wait a sec. There, I've let her out, so all is well with the local part of the universe. As I was saying, Babylon 5, interesting. It's a kind of groundbreaking science fiction TV series in a lot of ways. It was the start of progression where the characters mattered. It was character based in a lot of ways, even though there were much larger forces happening. And it's worth remembering for that reason as well. But thanks for that, Richard. And by the way, there's a PS from Richard as well, so I'll just play that one now.
Gary, this is Richard again with a PS. I have met one other person from Babylon 5. Mira Furlan, I believe is how you pronounce it. She played the character of Delenn. She also played the character of Danielle Russo on Lost. And it was pretty disappointing. I was actually really looking forward to meeting her because at that particular time, the day that she was there and the time that I was getting her autograph, it was really slow. And I was kind of hoping to have a little mini conversation with her. When the conventions are slow, that's your perfect time to talk to some of these people if they want to talk. She didn't want to talk. I tried, asked her a question about Babylon 5, and she just kind of nodded without ever really answering. I asked her a question about Lost, and she kind of responded, she says, well, those are things that I really, can't talk about. And it was just asking if she saw that her character was going to be coming back to the show, something like that. She was seemed pretty disinterested. She kind of signed the autograph and was ready for me to go away. And I'm not one of those chatty people. I mean, so I was kind of deflated because I normally don't start up conversations unless I really get the feeling that, A, there's going to be time, and B, they want to talk to you. And some of the stars, they will talk your ear off if you give them a chance. Other times, they just want to sign the autograph and let you be on your way. But most of them are usually very nice and will talk to you if they can, depending on if there's a line or whatnot. She apparently just wasn't in the mood to talk. So I was kind of disappointed with that. Not one of my autographs that I'm probably the most proud of. But in any case, I thought I would share another little anecdote about someone else from Babylon 5 that I met. Compared to like Bruce Boxleitner or Tracy Scoggins, obviously, those are great experiences. Yeah, Mira Furlan, not as much. Kind of disappointing. As always, take care.
Yeah, I've always got that disconnect with actors going to conventions and things. It's not my kind of convention to an extent, but I'm sorry you had the bad experiences with Richard. I tend to like writers better. Writers are much more interesting people, I find, than actors. And I'm not saying that because I know a few writers, but they tend to be more well-rounded personalities in a way. But I understand that there's a different kind of fandom than my own, which is your kind of fandom, where meeting the actors is a big part of it. But for me, writers are always a lot of fun and more inclined to be transgressive when they're having a talk or a chat. And I kind of like that. I like people who will say fuck if they mean fuck. And there are too many people involved in other parts of the science fiction world who protect their image a little bit too much, and that's always thing. The one thing he didn't say was, when you met Walter Koenig, was he wearing the wig or was he not wearing the wig? Because now he seems to have shucked the wig and he looks much better for it. But all through Babylon 5, one of the disconnects I had with it is that wig. It didn't serve him well. Let's just put it that way. But anyway, that's about it for the feedback. Again, thanks for listening. And again, there are a lot of other good podcasts out there. Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, of course. Hammockus, Silver and Gold, 1951 Down Place, B-Movie Cast, The Feminine Critique. If I'm missing anybody, I do apologize. Rotcast as well. Just, you know, go out there, listen to a lot of podcasts, get a widely ranging view of everything. Don't get outside your comfort zone with podcasts a little bit too. Don't just go with the things you might like. Go with things that people you know might like that aren't necessarily to do with what you're interested in. You can be surprised sometimes. Sometimes you're not. And which, for instance, is why I'm never going to listen to a sports podcast, for instance. But there are some good quality podcasts being done by some comedians now, which is a lot of fun to hear. They can be very hit and miss at times. They can be very in-jokey, but there are a few of them that are really worth checking out as well. So I'm going to leave you now. I've got 5 Bud Boudica westerns and The Bourne Legacy to watch. I'm in the mood for a little bit of a dull action, you know, like a meathead action film, and that's going to be my Blu-ray of choice at the moment. Take care. I'll be back in 4 weeks with Nick Sauer, and we're going to look at Mystery Men and then the specials directed by James Gunn. So that should be a lot of fun. And that'll be 4 weeks, 2 weeks from now, another Paleo Cinema podcast. I've got a couple of interesting films lined up for that already. I'm not going to talk about them. But anyway, email again, cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com. And having said that, see you later. Stay warm, particularly, and safe, particularly if you're on the east coast of the US or pretty much anywhere north of the equator at the moment, because it is a little bit cold in various places. I'm going to just sit here and enjoy the last tail end of summer. But I'll be back again in 4 weeks. And in the meantime, watch the skies.